WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this year, we published a story about protactile, an emerging language based on touch that's increasingly used by deafblind people. It was written by Andrew Leland, and one of Andrew's subjects was a man named John Lee Clark. Clark was born deaf, and he lost his sight when he was young to a condition called Usher syndrome. He became a poet and a scholar of literature, and a new collection of Clark's work is out this week. It's called How to Communicate. Andrew Leland was eager to speak with him again.
I first encountered John Lee Clark on an email listserv. Poetry Magazine was about to publish an essay he'd written, and I wrote to him asking for a copy. It was a casual request which began what was, for me, a life-changing correspondence. I have a related disease to Clark's. It's called RP, and it's causing me to slowly lose my sight. In Clark's writing and in our correspondence, I was struck again and again by the way he described his experience as a deafblind person. Despite the rest of the world's tendency to imagine deafblind life in tragic terms, as a land of silence and darkness, Clark's writing is full of humor and life. A running theme in his work is the importance of touch, a sense that sighted and hearing people tend to diminish or ignore. Let me give you an example, a poem of his called Clamor. It's being read here by Hallene, or Hal Anderson, a woman who frequently works with John as an interpreter.
Clamor. All things, living and dead, cry out to me when I touch them. The dog, gasping for air, is drowning in ecstasy, its neck shouting, dig in, slam me. Slam me, demands one door, while another asks to remain open. My wife again asks me, how did I know just where and how to caress her? I can be too eager to listen. The scar here on my thumb is a gift from a cracked bowl that begged to be broken.
To read and write, John usually uses a digital braille display, which converts the text on his computer into refreshable dots of braille on a little electronic device the size of a computer keyboard. As we corresponded, I began to imagine him in his home office in Minnesota, his cat asleep on his feet, playing that braille display like a virtuoso, firing off manifestos and poems and essays at all hours.
Great, yep. Okay.
We met up earlier this fall when he was visiting St. Louis.
Fantastic.
Great. Well, John, I'm so glad to see you again, to touch you again, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me again.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. This is great. It's great to be here with you.
That's Hal Anderson again. She's interpreting for John here using a language called protactile. Unlike American Sign Language, or ASL, which is a visual language, protactile happens entirely on the body. Think of rapid-fire taps, squeezes, traces, hand shapes, and presses that are all articulated on the hands, arms, shoulders, upper chest, lower thighs, and even the back. My hand that's on your knee is giving you feedback. So sometimes when you say something that, as frequently happens, rocks my world, blows my mind, I vigorously agree with, I will pat your knee like this. If you start saying something that I'm gravely, gravely disappointed with or disagree with vehemently, then I'm going to swipe and wipe, because that's the basic protactile that I know. And then if you crack me up, I do a spidery little tickle kind of on your knee.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Clark's first language, when he still had his sight as a child, was ASL. It's what his family spoke at home. And we started our conversation talking about that early part of his life.
The first day that I attended school, I went on the bus. And I got on the bus, boarded it, sat down, we took off. My mom didn't trust that I was going to actually like get there and be okay. And so she pulled up kind of behind the bus. She followed along the bus in her car and watched me. And when I got off the bus, she approached me and said, "So how was it? Were you okay?" And I said, I'm fine, but the bus driver seems to forget all how to talk, you know, all of the vocabulary. They couldn't talk with me. And she said, no, they're hearing. And I said, They're hearing? Well, what is that? So my mom had to explain to me that not everyone in the world spoke like we did. So I'm learning that there are other people in the world who essentially couldn't talk. That was a rude awakening.
I love that kind of inversion of how hearing people tend to frame deaf people. And it reminds us that the life of ASL is equal to that of English. And there's no reason why we need to center English in the way that the hearing world does.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Spot on, Andrew.
Yet, here you are with this magisterial book of poetry in magisterial English. So something happened along the way where you befriended English. And when and how did that happen?
Okay. Well, it's complicated. It's a little complicated. So being a baby, I immediately was immersed in the language of my family. And because I came from a deaf family, other kids knew that I was a source of information to them. You know, they didn't have a whole lot of other deaf role models in their lives. And so I ended up kind of being that for some kids. I took a leadership role as a child among my peers. And as I became more and more blind, as I got older, like, for example, in the sixth grade, I went to a school for the deaf as opposed to that little deaf program. And at that residential school, the school for the deaf, I had to abide by deaf customs, you know, and norms. And so I wound up at a crossroads because I wasn't deaf. I was deaf blind. At that age, even, I was deaf blind. And so I didn't fit the mold. I did not fit the deaf mold. And so, for example, I'll just give you an example here. Waving hands to get someone's attention is something that happens oftentimes. I wouldn't see someone who waved at me, and I would just go about my business, and they would think that I was being extremely rude because I wasn't responding appropriately. So people started to disregard me, to push me away. And so I was more isolated at that point. And so I got involved in books. I was like, well, if you guys are going to go on without me, well, then I've got better things to do than to go off with you, too. And I was hooked on books at that point because of what they are infected, I guess, with readerly disease, I guess you could call it. Yeah, because books did a whole lot for me. They helped me to get through a really tough time.
Any titles or authors come to mind as primary vehicles for that literary disease that you contracted in sixth grade?
Well, funny you ask. What happened was I entered a drugstore and they had some mass market books on the shelf. And I had to decide, I'm going to get a book. Okay, what book should I get? So I browsed for a little minute and, of course, happened upon a super thick book, all these other slim volumes. Ah, those aren't for me. I need to go after the biggest book I could find, you know? And it happened to be Ken Follett's The Pillars of the Earth. And I ended up going back to that drugstore to buy other books. Again, those mass market books that they sell. But I noticed, though, in reading them, that it was hard to read them because their print was so small. So I was trying to figure out, well, how can I get a hold of books with bigger print? And I went to the Goodwill, and they had lots of hardcover books. And so I graduated to those because they had larger print. And then after that, ended up going into frequenting used bookstores. And then Barnes & Noble, I'd go through the bins to see which books had the largest font, you know, that was large enough for me to read comfortably. So I didn't choose books based on the story, the content, the topic. If I could read them, if they were legible to me, you know, or visible, I guess, the font size was comfortable, then they passed muster. And it actually helped me. It did take me on a sort of certain trajectory, you know, in literature. I mean, Kafka, Nabokov, you know, those kinds of authors that it just happened to be that their books were printed with larger print. If I wasn't blind, I would probably have just stuck with the mass market media, and maybe I wouldn't have moved out of that genre altogether. So hidden blessings, Andrew. Mm.
I love that. You talked about this moment when you're realizing that your vision is changing, and it's changing the decisions you make and how you live. And I want to read a poem that I think connects to that experience, which, by the way, you know, is in a very different way, I guess, something that I'm going through myself. You know, so I identify a lot with what you're saying, too, just in terms of being blind. And yet also, you know, I'm about to read this poem off the page, and that's not a oxymoron, I guess.
Absolutely.
Okay. Goldilocks in denial. Goldilocks was in deep denial and refused to use a white cane. That's how she got lost in the woods, stumbling over tree roots and things. Then she hit a wall, a house, door. She entered and wrinkled her nose and remembered the Annie movie from when she was little. It was the part where Daddy Warbucks said, "I smell a wet dog." It was dark inside, so she did her ginger duck walk and zombie arms until she came against a table with some food on it. After emptying a bag of Doritos, she wandered deeper into the house. Kitchen, bathroom, living room, small chair, too small, medium-sized chair, too hard, big recliner. Ah, that's much better. When the three bears got home, they were happy to find that they had company. Papa Bear shook Goldilocks awake and asked, "Who you?" When she didn't answer, Papa Bear put his paw under her hand. She snatched her hand back and said, "I can see." Papa Bear said, "Okay," and asked again, "Who you?" She said, "I'm from Long Island, here vacation." Papa Bear asked, "When arrive here, you?" She said, "My name Yellow Curls." Papa Bear asked, "Need help, you?" She said, "We'll soon graduate, May." Papa Bear gave up and turned to Mama Bear and said, "Denial, obvious, misunderstand, misunderstand." Mama Bear said, "Sad, yes, nothing can do, leave alone." Baby Bear asked if he could play with Yellow Curls. Mama Bear thought about it and said, "No, better not. Yellow Curls' denial means hard talk, can't play good." So the whole bear clan went about their business as if Goldilocks wasn't sitting there. She jumped up and stamped her feet and said, "Not nice, you ignore, avoid me." She whirled around to make a dramatic exit, but ended up in the bedroom where she stumbled and fell into a bed. She stayed on the bed for a long time, pretending that she had planned to sleep there all along.
Nice. It shows a little bit of denial as a psychological state, right? But what happens later on, if a person's losing their vision or whatever, they sometimes try, I mean, things are overlooked, right? And when accidents do happen, people sometimes will, oh, well, I intended to do that. So it's a psychological effect that happens that I went through myself. I noticed myself doing it. And it's a person usually does that when they're not in a great place. But it's a, you know, it's a part of the journey, I would say. You know, it's part of the journey.
There's that moment in the poem when Papa Bear puts his paw underneath her hand in the way that, you know, your hand, the Hal's hand is underneath yours right now. And to me, just because I've spent time with you and have been experienced a projectile, it's clear to me as a somewhat initiated reader that that's a moment of saying, let's communicate tactilely. And part of her denial is to say, no, I can see, I don't need to communicate tactilely. And can you talk about that aspect of becoming deafblind and the way it changes how you communicate?
So as I said, you know, in that period of time where I maybe was in denial and things were getting muddled for me, and I probably did respond as Goldilocks did, off the mark, when people mentioned or said just certain things to me, certain comments, I didn't respond, you know, in kind. But I then became a role model for other deaf people. I'm a teacher, I provide training, I get other deaf people, deafblind people on board, and when I do that, there are other people who are in that denial phase, and that's tough for me as a teacher, and I think part of that frustration that I have with them potentially is my own frustration at myself, my past self, coming up and revisiting.
We're listening to a conversation between contributor Andrew Leland and the poet John Lee Clark. We'll continue in a moment.
WNYC Studios is supported by Wondery. 50 high school senior girls descend on Mobile, Alabama every summer to compete for a massive cash prize. It isn't Survivor. It's one of America's most lucrative scholarship competitions for teen girls. It's been around for 7 decades. Now you'll hear what took place behind the scenes. From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery comes The Competition. Host Shima Oliai was Nevada's contestant 20 years ago. Now she's returning as a judge to find out what 2 weeks with 50 of the country's most ambitious teens can tell us about girlhood in America. What happens when the competitors are thrown into the deep end with the best and brightest? And how does surviving the competition prepare them for everything that comes after? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I want to read another poem.
Yeah.
And this one makes me laugh every time I read it, in part because as a journalist who is writing about deafblind communities, I feel like it's a little bit of a warning sign. It's from Three Squared Cinquains. It's one of the Cinquains. The reporter is in awe. The reporter is in awe of a deafblind man who cooks without burning himself. Helen Keller is to blame. Can't I pick my nose without it being a miracle?
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I laugh because I'm a reporter and I'm in awe, and yet I want to know how to be impressed with you, John, and your accomplishments. Well, you're strangling me now.
You should not be in awe.
But I am. And I wonder, it raises, I think, a tricky and interesting and important question about disability, which is that on the one hand, like, you're doing incredible things. Like, you've written an incredible book of poetry. On the other hand, there is such a risk of becoming that reporter who's in awe. And I wonder, like, how do we avoid that infantilizing, you know, praising you for picking your nose while still recognizing the wonderful stuff you're doing?
Well, I don't know what to advise, but I think for me, I'm a little lucky. You know, one concept maybe, one place of struggle is when lots of people with disabilities are crying, screaming for access. You know, I want access. I want access. We have these rights. We want our rights to be protected. And I think that attitude might lend itself to certain other attitudes in response. And for me, I think I take things a little bit different. My take is a little bit different. I think it can actually be a boon. It can be a benefit when we have less access to the mainstream, because it means they have less access to us. And what that means is we then have at our disposal this beautiful community. I mean, a community that isn't being thrust upon by outside forces. We have, I mean, a whole wealth of things that we can then develop, and that we can, and we don't have to be stuck with just one world. Within, we can journey into and create all kinds of different approaches and things, because we don't have anyone else sort of breathing down our necks, expecting certain things, wanting certain things.
Let me read another one of these Cinquains just to add it to the conversation.
Okay, go for it.
I think it's a riff on Emily Dickinson. Am I a nobody too?
Yes, you got it.
I had some help from my wife, but am I a nobody too? I am sorry to disappoint, but I am. Yet nobody would let me be one. Not even when I catch a bus stinking of nobodies.
Well, maybe if some readers buy my book, they'll know I'm a deafblind poet at time of purchase. They're in awe just holding it in their hands. They haven't read a single poem, maybe. So they're just in awe, even finding out the piece of information of me being deafblind. Wait, a deafblind person got a book of poetry published a book of poetry? No way. The awe is there already. So I hope in those instances, in those cases, I hope that when they open that first cover, I hope that what strikes them first and foremost is a sense of disappointment. I want them to be disappointed. And then I want them to go, oh, this isn't what I thought. This isn't what I... And then I hope that they return to the text for the right reasons, Andrew. I have to tell you, I'm sorry that I am selfish. I'm a selfish person. I hope that people are in awe because the poetry they read strikes awe in them. and that they are amazed by the quality of the poems that's in the book. That's my hope, my selfish hope, Andrew.
So when we were setting up this interview, you made a joke over email about this tendency where people don't believe that the interpreter is really interpreting what the deafblind person is saying. And when I heard that, I felt really sad, but I also thought, really, you know, that's not going to be something that we're going to deal with today. And then I was talking to a friend who's very bright and really should know better. And he kind of was like, how do you know that's what, you know, that protocol is really a language and that it's not just the interpreter, you know, speaking for John or for the deafblind person. And my heart broke a little bit. And I just, what do you say to that person, you know, to the people out there who may be well-meaning, you know, but still find themselves in awe and even in disbelief of the idea that that protactile has the richness that it does.
I'm not too worried about saying anything to them, to be honest, because I do trust. I have faith in the listeners, Andrew. I trust that what they're imagining is wrong. I have faith that they are going to misconstrue some things and misconceive some things. But in that misconstrual and in some of those misconceptions, they're going to happen upon some things that are true. Many oppressed communities are really concerned with image and with representation. And they stress out about it. They worry. They take pulse, and you know they say, "Oh, how are they recognizing us? And are they really sort of seeing us for who we are? And how are we being portrayed?" And there's a lot of worry on the community's part about PR. I don't have a real connection with that feeling because those of us in the deafblind community, the experiences that we've had have been so, so rich that honestly, I don't really care. And I don't mean that in a rude way. I don't mean like, I don't care about these people. No. You know, I have friends that are hearing and sighted and I adore them, I love them. That's not my point. But my point is that I'm not going to deliberate over how to convince other people to approve of me and accept the language I'm using, and I'm not going to be scanning, you know, the horizon for naysayers. I'm going to be like, when this book is published, hey, if you're into it, you know, and that's something that you're eager to delve into, do it. If it doesn't float your boat, move on. That's, you know, with a shrug. I'm too busy to worry much about what that response is in terms of what other people are thinking.
The poet John Lee Clark talking with contributor Andrew Leland. Clark's new collection, How to Communicate, is out this week. We heard the voice of Helene Anderson, who translated from spoken English into protactile. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much for listening to the program today. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Adam Howard, Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, Mike Kutchman, Meher Bhatia, and James Napoli. And special thanks this week to Sarah Fenton.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.